Hey everyone, welcome to Office Hours with Cloud Posse, your weekly dose of insider DevOps trends, AWS news, and Terraform insights, all sourced from our SweetOps community, plus a live Q&A you can't find anywhere else. It's April 16th, 2025. I'm your host, Eric Osterman. Real quick, I'm the founder and CEO of Cloud Posse. We're a DevOps accelerator for AWS infrastructure that helps teams deploy their software faster. And we do this by leveraging our over 200 Terraform modules that have been downloaded hundreds of millions of times. So if you or your team has been banging your head against the wall with Terraform and just feel like there's got to be a better way, well, there is. And you can reach out to us to see how to do that. Go to cloudposse.com/meet. Again, cloudposse.com/meet. All right, so how can you maximize today's session? Well, first off, our format is very informal. You can engage as much as you'd like, ask questions. And if you're curious about any of our open source tools like Atmos or any of our Terraform modules, go for it. And for those on the recording, we host these calls live. You can join us by going to cloudposse.com/officehours. Again, cloudposse.com/officehours. So with that said, let's see here. Going to jump into some announcements. All right, lots of things crossed my desk this week. First one I just saw this morning was that 4chan. It was just hacked. I'm not sure how severe the hack was or what the attack vector was, but I'm surprised it hasn't happened sooner, given their clientele. Has anyone looked into what the attack vector was? All right. Next announcement was. Yeah, this was big news yesterday, I believe, when I saw it. So, in the US, there's a lot of cost cutting taking place with DOGE and other programs. Now, I don't want to make office hours political. This was the one of the programs that has been affected by it, and an 11-month contract extension was has ended, and there was concern about shutdown. So this is the CVE program that you are familiar with in our industry, all the security advisories that are published and syndicated affecting software around the world. Well, this has been anticipated. It did not come as surprise, and a foundation has been established now. Hold on, gotta do this thing where my office hour slides get. All right, yeah. So just announced is the CVE Foundation, which is a consortium coming together to ensure the ongoing support of the CVE program. Haven't read more into it than that, but it shows the resiliency of communities. Nothing more on that. So I thought this was an interesting thing. I saw it via Hacker News, and in our line of work, we might be recording videos that sometimes have sensitive information on the screen, and we think that if we just mask that through video editing, that we might be protected. Turns out that with video in particular, because there's so many frames and the frames are changing ever so slightly in between them, it's possible to reverse engineer that with some degree of certainty. And it was demonstrated here as part of a challenge that this guy Jeff put out, and had three people successfully depixelate a video that he had shared on YouTube. So kind of makes sense to me. I was kind of shocked, to be honest. But shows the power of modern machine learning. Anyone know more about this? Next announcement would be the Unsure calculator. I like this. So one of the things we always have to do in engineering is estimation. And what I thought was interesting about this calculator is it kind of makes it a little bit easier to present that in a statistical way. You can show here what that looks like, and it calculates the histogram of where the probabilities lie of where you'll finish based on your math. And it accepts a syntax that they describe down here below. I assume it supports standard things like parentheses. Just makes it easier to calculate your probabilities.
That tilde thing is like whatever, like a well-known format, like in mathematics, to say that you have a probability where you're giving a range somewhere where you say it's between this and this, kind of thing.
Got it. Just like we often say, it'll be about six.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
And that's giving like upper and lower bounds basically to that thing.
Yeah, so if we say between 90 and 100. Cool. Next announcement was one you shared with me, Matt. That was kind of crazy.
Yeah, I kind of laughed at that.
Yeah, so Figma sent a cease and desist to Lovable over a term that they were using called dev mode that apparently Figma has a trademark on. I mean, legally has a trademark on. This has got to be invalid. Have you any more info on this one, Matt?
I just read through the whole thing, and apparently, Lovable created a whole. So Lovable is, for anyone who doesn't know, is
Yeah,
like
I'm not familiar with it.
one of these like DevZero or whatever, where you can kind of prompt your way into like an app, like a front end app, and do a bunch of things like that. And I think they had in their product, they have something called like dev mode or whatever. So you can turn on dev mode and do something, and somehow I somehow that came to Figma's attention, and Figma now claims that they own, or I didn't verify it, but they do say that they own the trademark for dev mode. I can't believe that that would be defensible at all. Like, but it's funny that the cease and desist letter was very friendly and kind of chummy, but still told them to remove it from their product and stop using it. They were like, we're glad you think that this is a great term or something like that, but we own it, so you're not allowed to use it, kind of thing.
Crazy. And to file a trademark app, you have to show that it, A, you use it a lot, right? But then also that it's not already in use by a lot of others. And just a minor amount of Googling must produce that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how long they've had this trademark for, but I would,
Yeah.
in my mind, dev mode would probably be would certainly, oh yeah, certainly circa comes before 2023. I was gonna say before the existence of Figma, I would have said people were saying dev mode, but I don't know. That seems nuts to me. I think there's like, I forget exactly the term, but there's some sort of term about you can like in a trademark is invalidated when like a term becomes like, or when the term or phrase is in the popular lexicon or whatever, or something like that. And I think that if they actually got sued, they could just like use that as their defense, and I think that they would not. That couldn't possibly be upheld, but crazier
Yeah.
things have surprised me when courts get involved, so I have no idea, but it just seems nuts to me.
All right. So I think, what was it, last weekend we or last week rather, when we were on office hours, we talked about vibe coding, which is the current movement of tools like Cursor and now Copilot with its agent-based development
Oh,
capabilities.
I'm just laughing. There's Lovable li listed in blue on your thing. So there you go.
So it is really interesting, and when I saw this article, it kind of just confirmed what I don't know that I had been thinking about it, but just that it just affirmed that, obviously I'm not just the only one doing this and everyone's doing this. Where does that put the longevity of these no-code tools? And they've always been so frustrating, at least to, our audience here, any people with any development background and so forth. They're always limited in what you can do. And that's why the vibe coding is so effective, because it's basically imperative code, exactly what you want. And you can shape it as you prompt it to be what you want. I would not be excited about it if I had a no code solution, other than if we were implementing something akin to then what you're saying here with like Lovable or DevZero.
Yeah, I have kind of an interesting take on like this vibe coding thing, and I tried to think of an analogy, and I know it's a little far-fetched, but if all of a sudden you could hire vibe contractors to build you a house, would you go and do that? And I think my strong answer would be no. Like,
There's
the
truth.
number of times that, like, on the outside it looks pretty good, but you realize that they used cardboard instead of 2x4s, or they said 17 times, "Oh, I apologize for missing your requirement that you actually needed a flushable toilet," and that kind of thing. I mean, you can eventually get to good. I think it's a really good prototyping tool, and I think it helps you get to prototyping really quick. I personally just don't think it's quite there yet for truly production applications where you care about the architecture, you care about how it scales, you care about maintainability, all of those kinds of things. I don't think it's great for that, but it's definitely good for help me get some ideas out of my head and into some sort of like clickable prototype that really works, but doesn't work in a truly scalable, like, long-term way. And I'm not saying we'll never get there, but I just don't think we're there now.
I agree with that, based on my experience. It follows kind of this curve where it's like, oh my God, this is amazing. I can do absolutely anything. And you make tremendous progress, and then you start seeing where things fall apart. Constant regressions, constant unasked for refactoring, constant loss of logic, constant just forgetfulness. And that's obviously related to the small size of the context windows today. I have to imagine that's gonna, change quite rapidly given the amount of investment here. Less than 10 years, definitely. More than one year, probably.
I tried to build an application on the side where I wrote a very detailed PRD for it, and then wrote like these are the, and then used another tool that took the PRD and digested down into steps and how it should be implemented. And it did a really good job of that. I read the whole thing, and then I told Cursor and Claude, Sonnet 3.7 or whatever, to go like implement the PRD in the order that was specified. And it implemented step one and then went right to step three. I mean, like, very, very basic things. Like, it said step one, do this, step two, do this, step three, do this. And somehow it skipped right over step two. And I asked, like, why did you skip step two? And it's like, "Oh, I apologize. I do realize now that I've skipped step two. Let me go back." And I'm like, that's the most basic of basic things. Like, follow the direct instruction I gave you, and you can't do that. I don't quite understand.
I have noticed that, and I think this comes down to like just like we've developed tricks of the trade to develop in classical methods. I think the same things are evolving, right? For working with Cursor, similar. I've noticed like I have to constantly bite my tongue, or my hold back on what I say, because Because it will do that and it'll get too excited to implement the other things that we should really do later. So really, one thing at a time.
Yeah, I mean, I was pretty clear, like implement like each step fully and make sure the tests, pass and whatever,
Yeah.
and then it just literally skipped right over skipped step two somehow, and I was just like, why? Like how? Like some of them I can like sort of understand why it happened, but like these things I was just like, this makes no sense to me. Why did you do that?
I'm wondering if
So
there's also design patterns in how to organize a project that will reduce some of that. I acknowledge that some of the regressions that I've been having in the coding that I was doing with it are probably because I'm doing too much, let's say, in one component.
yeah, I mean there's definitely that. So the framework, just to, in case anyone's interested, the framework, if you want to pull it up, is called Taskmaster. And the whole idea is that you use that for, yeah, that's it, Claude Taskmaster. And the whole idea is that you run this thing against your, well, you can either have it prompt you and ask all the questions, or you can point to a PRD that you've already written, and then it takes that thing and it breaks it down. It uses, yeah, Anthropic and like so Claude models, and also use Perplexity to break it all down. And it really did a good job of breaking the things down that I asked it to into steps, but then it just did a really crappy job of keeping track of what had been done and truly being the taskmaster over Claude. So I had seen someone on YouTube like ranting and raving how good this was, and I'm like, okay, I'm gonna really try this. And I spent like an hour writing a true like deep PRD on something that I wanted to implement, and I'm like, here, go do this. And the breakdown was really good, but then like when I started saying like, go ahead and implement this, it just did not like do the right thing. And even when I told it, like, can you help me implement task three or whatever, like it says there, it still would like say that's already complete, and then it would move along. And I'm like, no, it's not complete. It doesn't do this, and this. And they're like, oh, I apologize for the oversight. And then it would start going back again. And I was like, this is frustrating.
Yeah.
Dusty, were you about to say something before or?
Yeah, I mean, I guess my question is the end product that you were aiming for achieved faster or cheaper given the edits, given the revisions? Because I think that's what's going to matter in the end. Right? Like if you're able to go back and tell it, you missed step three, you did it wrong here. How is that different from having an intern or a junior dev who submits to you his pull request and it's, or her pull request and it's garbage and you tell them to fix it?
Yeah.
And is the turnaround quicker? Is the overall expense quick, less? And if so, there's definitely a strategy here. It's a little mind-numbing and soul-crushing, but but there's a strategy, you know.
Yeah, it's not here today for sure. Like my most junior of junior interns, when I told them implement step two that's listed on this task list, and they just went and did four. And I said, and if I said to them, hey, dude, like, focus on what I'm telling you, do step two first. That needs to be done next. And if they came back three more times and hadn't done step two, they would get fired. Like, that's like the, that's the kind of thing here. Like, I mean, it's like basics,
I buy that. My question though is, were you able to get to a satisfactory solution, and were you able to do it in less time than it would take you with that trashy, horrible younger, like junior dev? Like, if it took you 15 minutes to get there instead of 2 days,
Yeah, I
right?
get that it's still like that would still be better. Yeah, I don't know. Like the whole the
I'm
to
not advocating.
yeah, no, I
I
get
don't
it.
love it.
I'm trying to answer your question like is like without bias. So my the whole reason I spent the time up front to do all this and try it and do whatever was to exercise the claims and the hype that this will help me build the thing that I want in, much faster than I'd be able to do it myself. And while it can do some things certainly faster, like than I can, it there was so much of that, hey, you missed this, hey, you didn't do this, hey, you didn't do that. Like, I didn't get that far. Like, I feel like I could have done steps one, two, and three easily in the time that it only did step one.
Right.
That kind of thing. So, and when you take into account like all the additional writing I did up front to try to make it super clear what I was trying to achieve, like I never would have done that. I just would have done step one and it would have been quicker. So I don't know that it quite saved me the time yet, but there are definitely tasks that it saves me tons of time on. Like AI, I mean, when I mean it, like AI in general, like saves me time on. So I think there are some things that it's there and some things that it's not. The problem is that those things are completely unpredictable to me. So that's why I get frustrated right now, where like you never know going into the task if AI will help you do it quicker or not, and until you do it. So it's kind of a leap of faith, and it's that part is what
At
frustrates
some
me.
cost, like you get far enough down this road, yeah, I'm constantly doing that. All right, let's see here. Get back to my browser. Next topic was DHH, who is always a little controversial, was posting something that developer machines are now getting so powerful. Why aren't we just running CI locally? Well, there are a few reasons why. I mean, one is ensuring environmental consistency. Two is the security implications. Well, if you need trusted secrets, that's a problem still locally. But the other is that where these tests actually run. Products like Dagger, Earthly, CI, and once upon a time, Waypoint were kind of trying to address this local CI aspect. This is, I guess, a reinforcement of something like that. Why this post was interesting was for me for two reasons. One was this idea, well, okay, let's assume that that is possible. Then how do you authenticate that the tests were actually run? And I believe that is what this tool is that they've written called GH sign-off. So I didn't realize that the GitHub CLI supports a porcelain style plugin system with extensions. So
Oh,
the
yeah.
GitHub, sorry.
I said, yeah, for a long time they've done that.
Yeah. So you can actually just install these extensions, kind of like you can with Helm or Git. And sign-off is written to work with that. So I'm not sure exactly how you integrate it with this to sign off that you ran the tests. That part is elusive to me. But the fact that there's a way you could is intriguing. Anyone know how this might work?
I believe that there's a check on the pull request, and this basically just satisfies the check by posting
Okay.
a check result to it.
So this is not doing anything from a security perspective, signing that the test succeeded, actually. It's a scout's honor.
I think it even says that in here. It says like
Okay.
your team, you already trusted your team with good test push deploy discipline. Merge queues, deployment pipelines,
Okay.
and high ceremony is blah, 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 something right there. So
Okay.
it's all too much. So it's basically saying you should just trust the developers to do
Okay.
this. So I also think that we should stop verifying security on the API too. We should only do it in the front end. Because like,
Exactly.
why do it twice? We
Exactly. It
trust
makes it so
everyone.
much simpler.
So I agree. There's some part of this that I agree with. So I agree with like that, and we've had these internal discussions where I fight for this a lot. I want to be able to run on my local machine. I want to be able to run the things that run in CI, right? Like linting and building and security checks and all of that kind of stuff. So I can get feedback quicker, so that I don't have to wait through a GitHub cycle to realize that I forgot to run prettier to format my code and it's off. 100%. That's what like commit hooks are for, right? So, if you want to add commit hooks, and this is controversial, but I know some people, some senior developers hate them, some really enjoy them. I happen to be one who likes them, but give me as a developer the way to run, or let me run them like by default. Let me override them if I want to do something quickly and push that doesn't run them locally on my machine, but then run CI in CI and build all this stuff. And check it through in a clean environment in something that replicates how it's going to be deployed to production, that uses the mandatory things that you say or that your organization has decided are mandatory in order to get code to production, etc. Like I think this is a whole naive like view of it, and maybe it works in the narrowly focused like way that they work on certain things that,
And small
37signals.
company.
Yeah. But I don't think it works in general as a general pattern. Excuse me, as a general
But I
pattern.
do like, I
There.
mean, I wish if GitHub were to revisit their implementation today and start from scratch, I wonder if they would start first getting a local, tool for GitHub Actions working, and then they offer a hosted version for your online CI. I
Yeah.
think that would have made it much nicer, so you can get what you want, a way to express, your workflows, run them locally, and then push it up and they get validated.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. It's weird because I think 37 signals has two unique problems. One is that they're very large from a revenue perspective. So they have a lot of extra like capital and ways to deploy things, like ways to deploy that capital to do certain things. But they're also a very small team that is narrowly focused on a framework that they write or they maintain to develop products, a small number of products that if things don't work, they bend the framework or make the framework do the things that they want them to do. And that gives them like it gives them a lot of power to be able to do that, but it also like makes them less real world than most other organizations out there in my view of it. So yeah.
That's a good point. Anyone have something to add to that? Let's see. Da, da, da. Yeah, so here it was a shocker to some degree. The YAML package for Go was archived. This is a perfect example of that meme where the whole internet depends on this one little project from some guy in Minnesota or something. That was this. And there's a write-up here about the author who started the project but just doesn't have time to continue maintaining it. So this is a very popular project among Go projects. That said, it hasn't really even been very much updated in the past 3 years anyways, but it just goes to show how stable it's been overall for YAML implementation. This affects us. This has been what we've been using in Atmos, so we're gonna have to rip that out. But this is something we've wanted to do anyways because there is a much nicer YAML parser that I found. And anybody who is affected by this should consider that as well. Let me just look up what that one was called. Yeah, this was it. I'll pull it up here. So this is the one that I think we're going to move to. It's also very popular YAML parser that's a lot more robust, has much better validation handling supports. It even supports comments in YAML, so you can reserialize YAML that you've decoded, and it'll persist the comments in there. And somewhere here, they have a screenshot of the validation. Like if there's a syntax error, it literally shows the line and the column where the syntax error appears.
Yeah,
So.
the one thing I really like about this implementation is it supports YAML anchors across files.
This supports YAML anchors across files?
Yeah.
Really?
Huh?
Show me.
Search
What?
for anchors. It's in here somewhere. There you go. Reference elements declared in another file.
Based on the example, I don't understand how it works, but
I think you have to load both of the like files into the decoder, but as long as you
okay.
do, it
I
will
got
essentially like look across that.
that's interesting. That would be amazing. Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm sold. So you've looked at this one in the past, Matt?
I think I don't want to get into the whole like inside baseball stuff here, but I think I actually recommended this a while ago. That it had some features above and beyond what we were using, and I think we just didn't want to spend the time to refactor at the time, but now that we might be forced to, this might make a lot more sense.
Wonder how much of a drop in this one is, if at all.
Eh. I mean, somewhat, but it's not,
Yeah.
it definitely needs work. Yeah, I mean, if you look at the other package, I'm not saying we made the wrong choice at the time, but if you look at that for like projects that are using it, it's like Helm and Kubernetes and whatever are all using this. So my guess would be that someone's going to fork this and maintain it going forward. I think it's even listed like right off of that like right off of the YAML Go YAML's not their website, their GitHub page. They actually
Well,
tell
we
you who
did.
they're.
So we looked into this, and there was a different project that Kubernetes is using, and it didn't support even anchors.
Oh, maybe it's not Kubernetes then, but Helm for
Or
sure, I believe, is using that.
other project. Yeah. All right. Next announcement. Yeah. So it's funny. I was talking with one of our developers last week, I think, about how awesome it would be if Terraform supported OCI as a backend type. And then I did a quick Google, and this PR had been opened just a few days earlier. And like the way it's written, you can see it's basically gotten sign off already that this will be merged into the Terraform core. This is the BSL licensed Terraform, not OpenTofu. I think they have since clarified the title. I think it was originally Terraform backend implementation for OCI, and now they say OCI object storage. And for anybody who is not using Oracle, then this is not as obvious. So this is Oracle's S3 alternative for object storage as a backend. So unfortunately, it's not what I was hoping it was going to be. And I don't know. For what it's worth, I posted my own comment here that I think they're going to call this one as implemented OCI, but I feel like that is not a great name for the provider, especially given that Oracle itself supports OCI, and OCI would be a great backend. There's also a proposal for OCI in OpenTofu, and I bet if we dug around, we'll find one for BSL Terraform as well. So yeah, if you feel the same, you can feel free to upvote. I don't find the chat. So why I think it would be really awesome for OCI as a backend type, because it's a open standard that supports a very efficient retrieval of objects and is supported by most major clouds out there. GitHub supports it. It would work pretty nicely with Terraform as a plug and play backend. Oh yeah, speaking of that, here is the OCI registry proposal for OpenTofu. The current state of it is that they've decided probably that they'll do it, but not until they first refactor how backends work in OpenTofu to make backends themselves pluggable, which is one of the, messy warts of Terraform core, is that the backend is not pluggable. It has to be added to the core itself.
Yeah. And this is actually going to mess with like what the comes from the Terraform SDK, like the I forget whatever it is, the whatever the SDK is called that lets you develop like providers and all of that kind of stuff, is that because it's not pluggable, there's a bunch of stuff that's hard coded in there, specifically for retrieving things from state and doing all
Got
these other
it.
things, and all that's going to have to be hooked to essentially like figure out like is it a new pluggable backend or one of the backends that
Yeah.
Terraform supports. And the only way I could think about that you'd be able to do that would be like they're going to have to monkey patch that somehow when they build when they build OpenTofu. So it doesn't seem like an easy thing, unless they re-implement all the providers, maybe all the backends in their own way, then maybe that would be the way that they do it. But I think business-wise, the reason that that isn't pluggable by HashiCorp is because they don't want competitors to be able to write a backend that's compatible to the Terraform, or that's a competitor, I should say, to the Terraform Cloud backend that they currently store. So it'd be really nice to be able to write your own backend. I think we would probably do that if we could do that right now.
Yeah, it's what led us down the path.
Yeah.
All
So, yeah.
right. Next announcement was this. Matt, I think you, I don't know if you had any thoughts on this one. There's been a lot of news about MCPs, which is how models can interact with other API endpoints. This is, I guess, how models or agents can interact with other agents. I guess the part that was not clear to me is why did we need another protocol and why couldn't it be MCP?
Well, I think MCP is very specific. This is like MCP is a way to, talk to other APIs or other programs or whatever that you want to kind of drive from your to drive from your model context, right? Where agent-to-agent or A-to-A protocol is basically so that agents can consult one another to ask their own questions and get answers back in a particular way. And I think that if you think about A-to-A, it's really supposed to be it's more like an internet, like truly a new internet protocol. Like instead of like HTTP, where you have these verbs and you can do these things and you expect you can set content types and you can get back, responses in a certain format and yada, yada, yada. I think they're trying to do that same thing with agents so that any agent that supports A to A will take a prompt for it to solve like in a specific format, and it will return things in the format specified as you ask for it over A to A, et cetera. So I think this is a more efficient way, specifically designed around agents to do it. And it's also, yeah, I was gonna say, it's also a pretty wide consortium of people who have said that they're gonna
Consultants.
participate.
It's really
Yeah.
interesting if you see who makes this list up. What stands out? Accenture, KPMG, Capgemini, PwC, Deloitte, etc.
Yeah, I mean, although that's not unusual with any large standards body,
Okay.
right? So if you go look at any large standards body, all of
Okay.
these companies participate in those too. There's because they have so much technology sway over the industry, those bodies want their input because of the fact that they touch so many customers, and
Yeah.
they can a ask their customers and solicited information from their customers and bring it to the body and all of that other kind of thing. But the difference between that and MCP, I think MCP is solely Anthropic who owns that like protocol,
Is
or
it?
like I'm
Oh,
almost
no.
positive that they're, or if it is, it's a much smaller group led by Anthropic that started that whole thing. So yeah, so I think this is more, although it's Google, who clearly when they're hosting it and they're running it, they have a lot of sway over things, but at least this is at least at the surface, like bought into by a large number of industry partners. So it should be interesting. But I think the big confusion, and I think that's what I posted on one of our internal Slack chats, was a lot of people are confusing them, and they are really for two different things.
Yeah,
You know.
as I was confused too.
Yeah, you know.
So the last thing that someone brought to my attention was Dependabot just released support for Helm so that it can automatically update your chart dependencies now.
Yeah. Is this an article from 2007 or whatever? Like, what first, what drove them to do this now? And why hasn't that existed for a
For a
long
long time.
time?
Yeah.
Very strange to me.
Interesting. Regex support for custom properties. Push rule delegated by. Oh, I misunderstood. I thought it was part of the Helm announcement.
Yeah. And I should have posted the article. I don't remember where I read it or whatever, but I read something recently that there's been a very large number of exits from Kubernetes as a platform. Like there's a trend of a lot of people exiting Kubernetes just because it's so large and so complicated, and what it takes to run it and keep it up to date and everything, all the things that we've talked about for so long. So I'm
I mean
dubious
that's
that now we're putting more effort into Helm, like they're supporting Helm, like from GitHub. That kind of like was like, really? So yeah.
Not that a successor has been nominated yet.
Well, I think most of what I saw, it's like ECS and the equivalent on GCP. I can't remember what that thing's called, but like the app runner or whatever it is, or something like that on
Quadrant.
GCP.
Cloud Run.
Cloud Runner, that's it. I can never keep this. I learned the AWS services, and I could never keep the other one straight, even though I've worked with them for a while and on a different bunch of different projects. I should have a map on my wall of like service to other each cloud service mapping.
All right, well, that's the end of my announcements. Anybody have something else interesting to share? Any questions they want to ask of the group? This is the open-ended portion of our office hours segment.
I have one thing that I just wanted to say. I think last week or 2 weeks ago, we talked about like the new agent that not agent the new model that showed up in what do you call it, run router, open router. I couldn't think of the name of the term, an open router, and it had like some
Quasar.
name, Quasar. It turns out that that was the new OpenAI 4.1 model that they just released yesterday. I think it was either yesterday or 2 days ago, which seems cost benefit wise to be one of the best models that has been released, but that's a whole different story. I guess we'll have to see how it plays out a little over time.
Does it still have the same kind of context windows as for?
It has a million token context
No
window.
way.
Yeah.
Awesome. Okay.
And it's like 10 cents a million in or something like that on the context window. So it's pretty cheap for something that does like, well, I'm talking about like this has the nano, mini, and like regular or whatever variants of it. Just like they're releasing every new model with that. So whatever the large like regular one is has, I think, a million token context window.
Question. All right. Any other questions or
Hey, yeah, this is Michael chiming in all the way back from last week. Just wanted to say shout out to everybody that lended a hand to the question that I had last week as far as tunneling or otherwise accessing resources that are in private subnets. And I think it was you, Eric, that suggested the Cloudflare tunneler. And so I was able to put together a solution around that, like a Python script that sort of wraps all the commands up and starts the tunnel on the remote server using AWS SSM, like run shell command, I think. And the output from that command gives you the URL. You click the URL, opens in your browser, and it's beautiful. Yeah, it just worked pretty much out of the box. So yeah, thanks for that.
And then that's just a one-time thing that you shut down once it's been configured.
Yeah, exactly. It's not some it's not one of the persistent tunnels that you can create if you actually open a Cloudflare account, define the tunnel, install the service on the EC2, and then they actually have uptime SLOs for those types of tunnels. But this tunnel has no guarantee of uptime. It's very ephemeral. You start it, use it, and you shut it down. And there were even a couple times where I started the tunnel and it didn't connect, so I had to stop it and restart it. So yeah, it works. It's not something that I would use for a production requirement, again, unless you go with the like super defined tunnel. But these ephemeral tunnels are just they're really cool.
I guess there's something I was researching this week and was floored that it's still so complicated. Trying to use something like AWS Inspector with AMIs and scanning them, and that every solution out there ends up becoming a complete like Lambda Rube Goldberg apparatus with like 25 different resources just to try and scan an image and update a tag. Is there? I was hoping that there would be something much simpler, literally like. Run one command against an AMI, brings it up, checks it, tags it, and that no infrastructure needs to be deployed, managed for such a simple thing. No takers.
I agree with you. I don't know a better solution right now. There's just, if you can come up with a simple to use security solution for the masses and deploy it out there, I think you would make a killing. Because everyone that I've ever used is like incredibly difficult to get running, like whatever it is, like command line secret scanning or all the way through IDPs and whatever. Like every piece of every layer of the security model, it seems overly complex to configure it and get something basic running.
It just, and like Inspector's been out for years, right? And AMIs have been out since the inception of AWS and EC2. I just find it baffling that they don't have a native like feature flag. You just select this and it scans the AMI for you. Or they have built-in testing for EC2 image builder. But there's no real way to do it there either. You can kick off the scan, but you don't know when the scan completes. All right. I'll keep looking. right. Well, any other questions? Nothing else from you, Michael?
Yeah, nothing else from me. Just par for the course on everything else. Cruising along.
Sounds good. All right, everyone. Well, thank you so much for your time today. Then we'll wrap up a little bit earlier and be back next week at the same time, same place. If you haven't yet subscribed to our YouTube channel, you can go to youtube.com/cloudposse. We'll be recording, we'll be posting a recording of today's session up there. And that's a great way to spread the knowledge with your team. If you found something interesting on today's office hours, just go to youtube.com/cloudposse where you'll find the recording and you can go share that. If you're interested to work with Cloud Posse at your organization, see if we can improve how you use Terraform, go to cloudposse.com/meet, answer one or two quick questions, and you'll book a meeting with me directly. If you're just getting involved with our community and office hours and what we do here at Cloud Posse, here's some other things you can check out. You can get our back catalog of all the past office hours episodes at podcast.cloudposse.com in audio format. We have our Slack community at slack.cloudposse.com, public and free for anyone to join. And if you haven't yet registered to attend these office hours live, you can do so by going to cloudposse.com/office hours. Again, cloudposse.com/office hours. All right. Thanks, everyone. Talk to you soon.